discerninghearts.com, in cooperation with the Institute for Priestly Formation, presents Marriage in the Lord with Deacon James Keating. Deacon Keating is the Director of Theological Formation at the Institute for Priestly Formation, located at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska. Deacon Keating has led more than 400 workshops in areas of morality and spirituality, and has authored numerous books, including The Way of Mystery, Listening for Truth, and Spiritual Fatherhood. Marriage in the Lord with Deacon James Keating. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. When we talk about marriage, at the heart of it, it is the relationship that we have as a couple with God. He is a part of the relationship of the male and the female in their union. And that relationship really is a relationship of love, isn't it?
From God comes our identity. And with that identity, He infuses us with the capacity to give ourselves away. We have to first receive our identity, obviously. To receive it as female, you have to receive it as male. You have to fully receive who you are. Once you fully receive who you are, of course, then you can give yourself to another, and really an other, someone who's different from you. The male gives to the female gives to the male. All in the context, though, of a continual and ongoing receptivity to God's love for you. And this is the mode of Catholic marriage. It's this openness to one another, and it's this openness to God as a couple and as individuals. And this is what sustains the mystery of marriage and, frankly, sustains our interest in one another. Because if we just maintain that marriage is a routine that we fall into as a couple, we get up this time of the day, we get ready for our day in this way, and then we return home in this way, and we spend our evening this way, obviously, we can just tell that this is going to be boring. This is going to be limited in interest. Now, of course, we're not at home yet anyway until we fully enter heaven. So there will always be times of a boredom, a limit, infinitude on this planet. But for a married couple, we're supposed to be happy. We're supposed to know happiness. And this happiness comes from remaining open to one another. And open to the love of God, constantly receiving this love by way of one another's love, by way of our individual prayer. And we ought not become cynical about this either. It's difficult and there's suffering that's involved, but we have a capacity to receive this love that is built right in us. God would not have created us male and female for one another if we also did not have the capacity to live a life of deep, loving communion with each other, which, of course, is the origin of our happiness. The origin of all happiness is to live in deep, loving communion with others. So we have this capacity. We have to draw from it. We have to have it ignited by spirituality, by a deep concern for the other. In other words, actually seeing your spouse, recognizing them, recognizing him or her as a dignified human being, looking at them, beholding them. And from this attitude will spring a renewed capacity to care for them and to receive and to give love to them. All of this, though, being drawn from a deeper spirituality that you have in your prayer life with God.
In 2331, in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it says, quote, God inscribed in the humanity of man and woman the vocation and thus the capacity and responsibility of love and communion, unquote. That responsibility of love.
There is a capacity in us to love, and with this capacity then comes the responsibility. It can't lay fallow. The capacity has to be activated, particularly when you say, I do, the time of your wedding. Once you say, I do, You're taking on the responsibility of actually being one who lives the vocation of giving the self away. And this vocation to give the self away is, ironically, the way of happiness. And of course, this is what Christ taught us in the Paschal Mystery, the mystery of his life, his death, and his resurrection. We are called to that same ironic or paradoxical life, that my happiness lies in responsibly, in being able to respond to my beloved in a way that draws myself, draws out of myself a concern for her or concern for him. And this is in the context of a continual struggle to have the ego deflated, the pathological orientation of drawing all things to myself, to have that deflated as I gaze or I behold or I begin to look upon the needs of my spouse as more demanding, as more urgent than my own needs. Now, all of this is developmental because of sin. We don't go into our first day of marriage ordered toward the self in this way. That would be most unusual. Not impossible, though, if you are raised in a saintly family. If you are raised in a saintly family with a saintly mother and father, it is very possible that you could enter your own marriage, your own wedding day, ordered toward the other. So it's unusual today because of our brokenness as human beings in the Western world, cooperating more and more with sin and egotism than with love in many cases. But it's certainly not impossible that the love that you saw between your mother and your father and the love that was bestowed upon you by your mother and father could have ordered you toward self-giving for 13, 14, 18, 21 years, however long you lived with your parents. Of course, our home of origin is the first school of marriage. So obviously, if you came from a mature, well-ordered, holy home, you do have a better chance of understanding what the church is viewing here as the ideal of marriage, that it is always ordered toward the other, and therein lies our own happiness.
They use the passage from Genesis chapter 1, 27 and 28, where it talks about how God created man in his own image, male and female, he created them. And that's so significant, isn't it, that when we see how God creates, he's creating, and then he gives. He gives them in the following passages. I give you this, I give you that. Be fertile and multiply. Subdue this, subdue that. It's that image of God that we're called to replicate. He never says, and then God took. It's always God gives. And that's what we're called to, isn't it?
Yeah, and on our side, we give when we feel secure, and we take when we feel insecure. So this is why it's so crucial for us to believe that the most powerful or the most fruitful human act is to receive the love of God. Because to receive the love of God is to receive security. To receive security enables us to give and to give and to give, as you say, God has done. And we can only do that if we have received this love of God, because God gives us the security to forget the self. To forget the self is the goal. Our fear is that if I forget myself, well, then what will happen to my needs? Our reassurance is that if you give yourself out of the love of God and for the love of spouse, what will happen to your needs? Your needs will be taken care of. And if your needs are out of line, and you basically have wants and not needs, your wants will be purified so that you will begin to live a more simple life. Because a lot of people do have misaligned that notion of need and want. And so when they actually say, well, if I think of you, what will happen to my needs? They're really saying, if I think of you, what will happen to my wants? What will happen to my egoism, my selfishness, my desire for this moment, my randomness about what I choose this day? Well, that's the real fear. And over time, in a life of prayer and in a life of openness to the needs of the spouse, your own wants or your own capricious desires will be purified, and you will actually become a simpler person so that you will begin to focus on the needs of the spouse as your want. You'll begin to focus on the needs of the spouse as your only desire. And of course, then you will be incredibly simple. Your life will be incredibly happy and simple because you're manifesting your image of God as one who just gives and gives. But first, there needs to be that secured interiority. You need to really receive the love of God so that you will have no doubt that if you think of another, your needs will also be thought of. Your needs will also be taken care of. Okay? In terms of a healthy marriage, anyway.
Sexuality does permeate all aspects of the human person. It finds a definitive role, how we view upon our roles in that marriage, depending on our gender and also our identity of that sexuality. Isn't that true?
Well, the complementarity of the sexes, again, orders, even right, as John Paul says in the Theology of the Body, orders us, even in our bodies, toward one another. This is the astounding fact, this is such a simple fact, that we make sex so complex today. It's right in the body, as John Paul. Just behold the bodies, and you will see what we are for. What we are for is to give the body to the other. And so sexuality, the complementarity of male and female, we are directed toward our beloved, and in that symbol of the body being directed toward the other, all the other goods of marriage flow. Particularly, obviously, the first one of creation of life. But then also the maintenance of the family. When you become mother and father, the maturity quickens apace because the kids are not going to give you anything. As you said before, in opposite of God, they're takers. And that's the way they are as little children. And so we have to be givers. And so not only in our bodies regarding male and female do we understand this movement toward the other, but once then the fruit of that self-giving in sexuality is known through the reproduction of children, we see very clearly that the giving then continues toward the children. Well, with all this giving, what the heck sustains the spouses? And of course, in our fear, that's what we ask. Well, I give, give, give. In marriage counseling, you hear this all the time, that one or the other spouse is complaining, I'm working too hard, I'm working all the time, I'm always giving. Well, this frustration is understandable if you haven't learned to receive. And this frustration is understandable if you don't live with a person who knows how to give. We're supposed to be sustained in our love for one another as spouses, which means there has to be this time for one another to both give and to receive, to both receive and to give. And this is why it's crucial that husbands and wives find really prayer time together, time where they focus only on one another and the intimacy that they need to have with one another. And as we noted in an earlier edition of our show, that this intimacy is about the sharing of the depths of your feelings, because these feelings carry truth. And one of the largest truths of us as married couples is that we just need one another. And we get out of sync and out of sorts, and we begin to be resentful about the giving that marriage and family life demands. When we miss one another as spouses, miss each other emotionally, and also miss each other locationally. We're so busy, we're not even with each other physically. We're not in the same house. We're not in the same yard. We're not in the same car. We just miss each other. But then when we are together physically in the same geographic space, well, then we miss each other emotionally because one or the other doesn't know how to give the spouse time, time to open up, time to tell his or her true feelings, and then the capacity to receive those feelings in a non-judgmental way. All of these character traits, virtues, are crucial so that we don't resent children and all that they demand and all that they take from us. So treasuring the intimacy that we have with each other as spouses is an urgent demand of love. It has nothing to do with being selfish. It is an urgent demand of love. And the church, your mother and father, other good spouses, your prayer life, all of these have to teach you how to be available to each other. Or yes, marriage, family, will just become something you resent.
2333 in the Catechism says this, "The harmony of the couple and of society depends in part on the way in which the complementarity, needs, and mutual support between the sexes are lived out." In that sentence, I mean, there is such a gravitas to marriage when you think of the harmony of the couple and of society. I mean, it seems as though the society, is it dependent upon what happens between that couple?
The Catholic Church has always taught that marriage is the foundation of public life. Marriage is the foundation of society. And so if we do have marriages wherein the couples have no peace, then of course it stands to reason that the society will have no peace. This is the great fear in the Catholic Church of divorce, the great fear of single-parent families. Not in a judgment in terms of how well the woman or the man is coping in such a situation that is less than ideal. The Church lauds single mothers and fathers for doing the best they can. But that's not the way it was supposed to be. That's not the way God wants it. God wants couples to give birth to children in the security of their bond, the bond of the covenant that they promise to each other, that in good times and bad times, I will stay with you. And so the society suffers when marriage suffers. Society is weakened when couples are, for whatever reason, unable to reach one another in love and to break up. So this is crucial in our understanding of society, that marriage is not random value that can come or go, but marriage is the bedrock of peace. Peace for your neighborhood, peace for your town, your city, where there are healthy families, where there are husbands and wives making time for each other, securing one another in their love, one for the other, in deep bonds of intimacy, where the mother and father are available to their children, where especially the father is teaching his sons about interiority, about sharing and understanding feelings, then the neighborhood benefits, then the town benefits, because what's coming out of these families is the origin of peace. And then the town or the city is shrouded in peace. And so when the Catechism talks about the harmony of the couple and society, depending on how the sexes live out this love, they're not exaggerating. Remember, this is God's idea. So, since it comes from God, God must have known that male and female stabilize the world in their love for one another and in their love for their children.
Again, we go back to that image that God gives man and woman an equal personal dignity, that He created them, male and female, in His image. So often in marriage, there's an idea that somehow one in the couple is dominant over the other. Again, just to reiterate, it's just not true.
The equality of the male and the female is in their dignity, which is so crucial. The roles that we play, they may be somewhat more arbitrary according to the couple. We all know that there are husbands that stay home and there are wives that work outside the home. It's the equality that they treat each other with, that they receive from each other. They are equal in dignity. I don't think we ever want a culture where male and female are somehow, in that ludicrous movement of the 60s, unisex. There is a differentiation of male and female. There is a differentiation of roles. But there's always equal personal dignity. And the roles that women play or that male play are somewhat dependent on the society that we live in our particular age. But the equal personal dignity is constant, constant throughout time. And of course, we've seen through history where some of the social roles became conflated with the question of dignity. Well, we know that there were times where the structure of the family was perhaps too tight. The structure of the family and its roles were given perhaps too much in an authoritarian way by church and society and politics and economics too. But the key truth here is that male and female are equal in dignity. How we work out our particular work roles, to some extent, are up to the prudence and the conscience of each individual married couple, but never should it be doubted of their equality.
When we talk about marriage and how it is that mutual self-giving and it's the image of God in that marriage and how we are witness to the world, help me to understand how marriage has come to a point in this day where people will enter into this and have to have a prenuptial agreement just in case. Just in case. I mean, why do we bother getting married if there's a just in case?
Well, I think one of the origins of that is the mystery of suffering and the confusion of the mystery of suffering with a lack of happiness. And when we started confusing suffering with a lack of happiness, I think we began to look to where the grass might be greener. And to lose the mystery of suffering is when we lose connection with the mystery of Christ. And so once we lost the mystery of Christ in marriage through secularization, then we lost the good of any suffering. And then when suffering began to come in marriage, which it's inevitable, it will be there. We will suffer, in some cases, physical suffering. Sickness will come to us. Ignorance will come to us in marriage. Sin will come to us in marriage by our own choice. And all of these bring suffering with them. But if it's separated from the mystery of Christ, then you look upon your spouse who may be causing you suffering, and it begins to be absurd. I'm only 25, I'm only 30 years old. I'm going to spend 50 years with this guy? Doesn't make sense. I want to be happy, the person will say. I want to be happy. And so when we disassociate the suffering that will befall anyone, because we know in a very pathetic and strange way that once you leave that husband, the next one that you marry will also cause suffering. There's no escape from this. It'll be a different type of suffering. It may be a different degree, but there's no escape. And so to run from suffering is to run from the human realm, which is absurd. But we do. We keep running, looking for some vague and elusive form of happiness that we will never find because we have severed our understanding of marriage from commitment, come what may. And it is commitment, come what may, that in a strange way connected to Jesus brings our happiness. And so when we have prenuptial agreements, what we're saying is, I'll marry you, but I'm afraid. What are you afraid of? I'm afraid that if I say yes to you, I'll have to stay with you, even though I will suffer. Yes, you will. Well, in that case, I'd like a way out, please. So I think the fear of suffering has led us to this escape clause mentality regarding marriage. So catechetically, spiritually, we need a much more profound entrance into the mystery of Christ's life, death, and resurrection in our parishes. If we are ever going to turn the ship around regarding marriage. Because unless we fully understand what love asks and what comes with love, our suffering and our happiness, we will always let fear of suffering trump our freedom to stay, and we will run. It's Christ who enables us to stay, even though we are afraid, and even though suffering comes. Because what he brings with him is meaning. He brings meaning in the midst of suffering. And he brings courage in the face of our desire to run. And when we stay with our spouse, despite the suffering that it may bring, we give this public witness that there is hope. And hope is a valuable public virtue that we need more and more today. In the wake of cynicism and meaninglessness, for a couple to stay together, let's just say that there's a physical handicap that comes early on in the marriage, and the wife is tempted to leave the husband. But if she suffers with Christ through the appropriation of her yes to this man, She will give us great hope. And she will minister to thousands who perhaps never say a word to her, but see her in her fidelity, even though it caused her pain. See her in her fidelity as a sign of the living God, who always chooses us, even in our sin, even in our weakness, and never abandons us. And she becomes this living sign of God's fidelity. But she must first receive this mystery of God's love for her in Jesus, if she is ever to stay in a relationship of some pain or suffering. She must receive the love of Jesus on the cross. And so, in today's world, we put limitations on love because we are afraid. We are afraid of the stations of the cross that follow every married couple, that enter every marriage. But we always must remember that if we are faithful to these stations of the cross, they end in resurrection. And while we are walking the stations of the cross, we draw our happiness from a deep communion with Jesus that eye has not seen and ear has not heard, and nor has even dawned upon you until you have entered into this fidelity. So can we minister to people a healing of fear, a healing of suffering, a healing of the fear of suffering that comes from our yes until death do us part? And of course the answer is yes, because to do that we simply need to be open to receive the mystery of Christ in the Eucharist.
We're out of time for this segment. Any final thoughts, Deacon Keating?
We just ask the Lord to bless all of those who are in any way suffering as a result of their choice to love, and that the Spirit will sustain them in this beauty that they have chosen to enter, that I will love you. I will love you always, no matter what comes. To love like God, to love in God. This is the hope of our society today.
Thank you, Deacon Keating.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Marriage in the Lord with Deacon James Keating. To hear and or to download this conversation, along with hundreds of other spiritual programs, visit discerninghearts.com. This has been a production of Discerning Hearts in cooperation with the Institute for Priestly Formation. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. We pray that if this has been helpful for you, that you will first pray for our mission, and if you feel us worthy, consider a charitable donation, which is fully tax deductible, to support our efforts. But most of all, we pray that you will tell a friend about discerninghearts.com and join us next time for Marriage in the Lord with Deacon James Keating.